Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Here on Rainbow Soul, feels good to be here as always. We have a wonderful, wonderful guest with us tonight. He's a journalist, a novelist, a TV host. He's a cultural critic. This brother is everywhere. He's across all platforms, all around the world on the various venues that he works on and the people that he works for. His writing is regularly appears in publications such as the New York Times, Ebony, the New Yorker. He has a new book out tonight, and that's why he's here. There's a foreword by Michael Eric Dyson, and he says this. He says, "That's why I'm so glad that there's ingenious black folk like Toure exist. He's free to be black the way he sees it, and he feels no need, that's right, no need to apologize for who he is or what he says or thinks. Ever see him on television? He's a riot of complicated blackness. He's handsome, chiseled face, all aglow with mischievous ideas about the world we live in, delivered in an over-the-top style that dares the stereotype of the loud black man to darken his reputation, even as his mind races to put pop culture and politics into intelligent perspective." And with me on the line tonight is a wonderful brother. He's been doing so many things. He's already accumulated a wonderful, wonderful body of work, and he still has such a long, long way to go, such much of more contribution that he's going to make to this planet. Brother Toure, welcome to the program tonight.
Thank you. How are you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's good to have you here. You have a new book out now. It's called Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness?
Yeah.
And we're going to get to that in just a minute. But what I'd like to do, I like to always do with my guests, since we have a full hour here, is there's a lot of people out there listening who know you or who are familiar with your work, and they'd like to know a little bit about you. So what got you on this career path?
I mean, I always wanted to be a writer. I think, you know, when I came out of college, that was my dream to write, to be a writer. I mean, we kind of started in college. There was an incident that would only really matter to college students. There was a black student had a party. You know, you would sign a contract to have a party at a little space on campus for a certain period of time. And supposedly, maybe it happened, maybe it didn't, somebody called and said that there was noisy, and the police came and shut it down like an hour early or something, and we were very offended that that happened. And like 20 of us wrote letters to the school paper, and they did the right thing journalistically, but we were offended. They condensed all our letters, which pretty much all said the same thing, into one letter with 20 signatures, because we thought writing 20 letters that they're going to have to print a bunch of them and we're going to clog up their whole letter section. And no, they made the right choice as journalists. They condensed into one letter. But we didn't understand that. We were very offended. And we felt our voice was silenced. And I took it on myself to create a black nationalist newspaper that operated on the campus and really talked about sort of national issues. But if you wanted to talk about something that was going on campus or in Atlanta, I was at Emory University, you could do that too. It was all editorials. There was no reporting. And I ended up writing most of the stories because, you know, most of the students were pretty busy with their classwork to stop and write something for had nothing to do with class. But a couple helped me out every issue. But it was called The Fire This Time. And it was really writing as a political gesture for me, not yet as an artistic gesture. But, you know, I saw how writing could start to affect people and how, you know, it got the community talking back to you. And that sort of started me thinking about being a writer. And one day in the course of working on that, I called Rolling Stone magazine for something, and somebody talked to me for about half an hour, and then I was kind of like, well, who are you that you would have half an hour to just sit and talk to me? And she said, well, I'm an intern. And I said, oh, wow, they have interns? Who knew that such a thing existed up there at Rolling Stone? And so I applied for an internship, and I got it, and that's when I started moving toward writing about music.
Wow. And according to the research that I did, you actually dropped out of Emory, right?
I did 3 years at Emory, and my third year I kept thinking and asking people, why are we doing this? What is the point of this exercise that is called the liberal arts education? What is the value of this? And nobody could explain it to me. And I could explain to somebody now, but nobody could explain it to me then. And, you know, I asked my friends who were in graduate school, I asked professors, I asked administrators, and nobody could explain to me why. And because I didn't understand why we were doing it and how that led to career, I couldn't do it anymore. So after junior year, I went to New York City, hung out for the summer, tried to meet people, worked in restaurants, interned at Rolling Stone, got a little story in The Source, got a little story in The Village Voice, finally got a little story in Rolling Stone, and never left.
And it's been beautiful ever since. So that was probably, in your opinion, one of the best decisions that you've ever made, correct?
I mean, it worked out. Let's say that. Could I have finished college? Sure. I mean, at the time, I thought that I had some great momentum for my career. In retrospect, I see I did not, and there was no need for me to stay. I mean, it wasn't like, well, if you go back to Atlanta, then you're off the carousel and it's hard to get back on. I surely could have continued my career with a degree. I just wish I understood why a degree was so important. I was fortunate to go into a career in which a degree almost never matters and nobody's ever asking you if you have a degree. So it worked out. I wouldn't necessarily say it was a necessary decision. It was a very youthful decision.
Yeah, I agree. You kind of need hands-on experience. I had a similar experience. I had gone to LIU in Brooklyn Center, and I was studying media arts and television, and I was doing things. Back then we were doing music videos, and I was doing all kinds of shows, but you still needed that connection to get in. So I just, even though I was working, I had worked on a show called Today's Black Woman with Frida Payne back in the day, and even after having done that show as a PA, I said, you know what, I need to get into, some kind of company that is doing this so that I can get seen, get known, and if I could just get in the building, I'll know that I'll make it happen for myself. And I did the same thing. I didn't go to work directly because obviously no one was going to hire a young kid out of school, to be a cameraman or whatever. So I went to NBC, became an intern, and I knew once I got in, I'd make it happen, and the rest was history for me. So I kind of understand what you're talking about in terms of, taking that leap of faith. We're going to get to your book, but just real quickly, I kind of want to shape, who you are. What kind of childhood did you have? Did you have any sisters, brothers? Did you have a two-parent household? What was that situation?
Yeah, I mean, I got a younger sister. She's a year younger. Now she's an emergency room doctor in New York. I want to call it upstate, but it's not upstate. She's just a little above New York City, but to me, anything above 57th Street is upstate. Two-parent household. My parents had been together a long time before they had us. They're still together, and they're still very happy to be together. And, they are an extraordinary example of a marriage, a successful marriage, and just having a father around. I mean, almost all of us have a mother, and mothers are extraordinary, but a lot of black men of my generation, a little older than me, a little younger than me, don't have an example of a positive father. And it was very extraordinary, and obviously life-altering to have a father there all the time, strong example of what it means to be a man, clear example of how to treat women and how not to treat women. And I see it all the time. I was with my parents the other day, bicker about a little something, no big deal. And a second later, the other one has forgotten what happened, and they're back to, like, giggling and laughing together. And I'm like, you know, that was really awesome, you know, because a lot of people would be like, oh, you annoyed me, now I'm upset with you for a certain period of time. And, like, you guys, you know, you just forgive each other really quick, and they're like, yeah, what else are you going to do? You sit around and argue, you know. I remember being very young, and my mom and my sister had gone somewhere, and I said, Dad, let's hide in the closet and jump out and scare them when they come in. It's probably like 4 or 5 years old. And I remember he was like, no, we don't do that to the girls. We don't scare them like that. You know, and it's just always like those just little lessons. No, nothing major, no wisdom, but that, you know, anybody else wouldn't have, but just little things about respecting mom and respecting your sister and women, and, you know, just sort of taught me to take women seriously, you know, and show them respect. And a lot of brothers are not necessarily getting those messages at home.
Yeah. So that you must say that has impacted your relationship, because you're married, right? I think you have one daughter.
I have a boy who's 3 and a half. His name is Hendrix. And I have a girl who's 2 and a half, and her name is Feyruz. And yeah, I've been married about 6-7 years. And
wow.
Yeah.
So definitely you would agree that your environment has played an important and positive role.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, in so many ways. I mean, I think about my father. He's retired now, but he was an accountant, and he had his own firm, and, you know, he worked extremely hard and worked a lot, and, you know, was definitely in control of his world and was never, like, you know, complaining about a boss, you know, because he was the boss, you know. But he was very nice to everybody around him. He wasn't imperious, you know, as a boss. And, you know, I definitely got from him the example of, like, just working hard and working all the time. And I can never, ever recall him taking a day off from work. And, you know, I don't, you know, ever take a day off from work. I mean, like, my entire childhood, I can never remember him being so sick that he couldn't go to work. And, you know, and, I mean, you know, he had 1,000-some clients in the, you know, throughout the city of Boston, and, you know, go to people's homes at night and whatever they needed. And, you know, it was just really amazing example of working hard. And, you know, I sort of take that into my life, you know, just working all the time on all the things that I got to do and never sort of complaining about, like, you know, wow, you know, because sometimes it is kind of dizzying, you know, so much to do and jumping from one show, the hip-hop shop, to doing something political on MSNBC, to doing something cultural in my writing, to then parenting, then back to something entirely different and sociological with my book. And, you know, it's sort of these code shifts all the time. And, you know, it can be sort of dizzying, but, you know, think about him, and I'm like, you know, he got to keep going. This is what it is. It's what it means to be a father. You know, it's what it means to be, you know, the man of the family. And my mom was great because for a lot of reasons, but she let me know in subtle ways from a very young age that it would be totally cool with her for me to be a writer. And so I knew when it started to become clear in my mind that I wanted to be a writer, I knew that that would be fine with her. I think especially in a lot of black families, if you say you want to be a writer, at first they're like, whoa, what? Like, you're going to be broke? No, you know. Maybe they'll be with it, maybe not, but, you know, a lot of families, you know, might find that economically challenging, you know what I mean? And she was with it, you know, and I knew she'd be with it, and I knew the esteem that she held writers in so that it would be, you know, respected decision by her. So, you know, she's definitely helped me. She's definitely helped me become a writer.
Yeah, and it's actually, I think it's had a great impact in the sense that you're able to juggle so many things. I mean, this generation, The term multitasking, and I just find it incredible that, as you said, you're able to go from all of these different venues. It's really a wonderful, wonderful thing. I love the stuff that you do on Fuse. I love the interviews. I mean, you've interviewed just about every and anybody. What would you say is your favorite interview that you've done so far with the musical
art? I can't say a favorite because there have been so many great ones, and because part of what I try to do is the I never want, like, the favorite or the best or whatever to be in the past, because then, that was the high point. It's gone. It's behind me. I always want really to be focused on and excited about the next one, and the next one is going to be the best ever and the most exciting, the most fun. And, the future has to be better and, more exciting than the past, or it's a little depressing. I had incredible interviews with Questlove, with Tupac, Jay-Z's very easy to talk to, Lady Gaga, great interview, 50 Cent's pretty good interview, had a wild one with Courtney Love, had a wild one with R. Kelly. Sure, I'll think of some more as we go along. But
you've done Alicia Keys, Snoop. I mean, yeah. Like I said, Beyonce, DMX, yeah. Lauryn Hill. I mean, you have really had a chance to sit down and talk to a lot of people. And I think it's tribute to you because, folks don't, always want to sit down and speak with certain people. So I think that, you obviously make people feel comfortable. They think that you have enough personality that you're going to be able to bounce off of them in a positive way. I really do love that. Talk a little bit about the other show that you do on the record, because that's kind of interesting as well.
Yeah, I mean, On the Record is a pretty interesting show. I sit and talk to artists for an hour.
Yeah.
And you have an hour with somebody, as we're going to see tonight. You really can get deep and you can get into a lot of different things, and you can talk about people's family and kids and, why did you do this and why did you make that choice and, really have a deep conversation. And that's what I like to do. The show started off with a Jay-Z interview that was supposed to last 20 minutes. And in terms of television, if I talk to you for 20 minutes, that's not enough to make a half hour of TV. So we'll probably cut it up into, a bunch, like 3 or 4 3-minute segments. But I know Jay. It was a special interview, but I know Jay. And, he likes talking to me, So he sat there for 45 minutes. Well, that's enough to make a half-hour show out of. So, we put it out as a half-hour show. And a bunch of other artists called and said, we want to do that. And the show arose organically in that way. We started talking to other artists and became an ongoing show. And it's definitely one of, if not my absolute favorite thing to do, because I just love doing interviews and I love talking to people and I love sort of, having all this time to get into these people's heads and see what they're all about.
Yeah, and what they're thinking about. I'm a huge fan of Tupac. What was that experience like, being face-to-face with Tupac and getting that interview with him?
That was pretty incredible. I talked to Pac a couple of times for MTV and for I was with the Village Voice during his sexual assault trial in Manhattan that he was found guilty and went away for a while. So that's before he was with Death Row, because when he came out of that, Suge took him and they went to Death Row. It was extraordinary. He's brilliant. He's funny. He's witty. He's crazy and yet incredibly clear-eyed. It would be like talking to a preacher / black power activist / philosopher / politician / thug all in one. And, he would say these incredibly perceptive things and sensitive things. And then right after that, he'd say something really astute and interesting politically. And then he's sort of like, you know, sort of saying something that's kind of like off the wall and like, you got to be kidding me. You can't really think that. But extraordinarily passionate and extraordinarily just powerful and shining in this way. And, you know, I mean, like literally bright and, you know, I mean, quite visibly different than all the people around him. You know, and I mean, I remember, you know, the difference from the beginning of the trial when he'd sort of like be hanging out in the hallways and like one or two or three reporters would come up to him in the hallway and just be talking to him and he'd just be making jokes about the whole proceeding. Not that he thought of it as a joke, but just sort of making jokes about like what was going on. I remember him talking once about how he was the only person in the courtroom who was not on the clock. Like, everybody else in the courtroom was getting paid to be there except for him. You know, a couple weeks later when the trial was in full swing, and he's like probably maybe a week and a half later when trial's in full swing, and, you know, he'd be outside with a throng of reporters, a beehive, 30, 40 people, you know, all crowding around at these impromptu press conferences, listening to him hold forth and hold court and spit his game and his knowledge, his wisdom, his zaniness and all that. And pretty extraordinary situation. Pretty extraordinary guy.
Yeah, it must have been. Now, what venue do you prefer the most? Do you like the writing, the television, the radio? Because I know you do a little radio as well. What excites you the most?
Very little radio. I like all of it. You know what I mean? I can't pick one. You know what I mean? I like the immediacy and electricity of television. But, you know, the ideas, you know, it's very sort of relatively shallow with the ideas. I only have 30 seconds, or maybe on MSNBC, 2 minutes to explain my ideas. It can only get so deep. Versus, you know, when I'm writing something that's 500 words or 1,000 words, you know, it can actually get really deep. You know, then, you know, you work on a book and you can get, like, really deep with something. And I like that a lot, you know what I mean, to be able to get really deep in an idea. So, you know, I need a little of both. You know, I got a book coming up. I'm working on another one, you know. I got to have a little bit of both.
Well, talking about your book, it's a great segue. Your book, your current book, is Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness, What It Means to Be Black Now. Why don't you define for our listeners what that word phrase, post-blackness, is referring to
Post-black is a term that comes from the art world. Thelma Golden, the great curator for the Studio Museum of Harlem, and Glenn Ligon, the great visual artist, coined it in the 90s. Early 2000s, when they saw a group of artists coming up who they realized were rooted in but not constrained by blackness. So they're coming from black traditions, they want to talk about black subjects and black people, but at the same time they don't want to be limited to that. You see sort of an example, a precursor to this sort of group, you know, and an influence on them, in Jean-Michel Basquiat, who's painting about black people some of the time and not about black people some of the time. He's painting, his paintings are referencing African traditions, Haitian traditions, Caribbean traditions sometimes, black American traditions sometimes, and sometimes his paintings are referencing European traditions or, you know, white American artists like Andy Warhol. You know, he was not sort of always talking about what it meant to be black in his art, and not always necessarily complimentary of what it meant to be black in his art. He's painting Irony of the Negro Policeman, which is sort of, you know, obviously criticizing sort of black man who's a policeman. But it's a nuanced criticism. It's not just saying he's whack because he's a policeman. It's the irony. You know, as opposed to the great and necessary work of Romare Bearden or Jacob Lawrence or William Johnson or Henry Tanner, which was amazing work, necessary for its time, apropos of its time. They're always talking about black people, they're always dealing with black traditions, and they're always dealing with making black people look great and heroic and beautiful and brilliant. And that is fantastic work, and I love that work, and it's right for its time. But this is a different time. And, you know, we don't necessarily need to go around saying black is beautiful. Because, you know, at this point, I know black is beautiful. You know black is beautiful. So who am I convincing with saying that? If that's my ethos in my art or my writing or what have you, who am I talking to? Certainly not talking to black people. Talking to white people. Why am I going around trying to convince them? If they haven't figured that out already, then they're not gonna. You know what I mean? Look at it like this. You know, I have a vision of black people. Let's say, put that in a box. I know that we are brilliant. I know that we are beautiful. You know, sometimes we're a little messed up. But for the most part, we're brilliant and beautiful. And I'm not just talking about the celebrity level. I'm talking about every level of the game. You know, we have some problems, but I think we're an awesome group of people.
Absolutely.
Nothing is raising or lowering that. Barack Obama coming along does not raise my opinion of black people. I knew we were already good enough for that, and I knew that black people were already that excellent. I mean, he's extraordinary, but he does not raise the ceiling of how I think of black people. And when I see Obama on the street or Flavor Flav or the basketball wives or whatever, that does not lower what I think of black people. You know, nothing could raise or lower what I think of black people, you know, and I think that would be true of you and true of most black people, that we already know how we feel about each other and we already love and admire us as a community. So if you're making art or talking in a way that's meant to sort of change how people think about black people, you're not talking to us, because we know. Maybe you're talking to kids, but that's something else. You're probably talking to white people. Why are you spending your time talking to them about how beautiful we are? If they haven't gotten it already, they're not going to get it. And, I mean, for me, the first level of black intellectual maturation is to reject the white gaze, right? G-A-Z-E, you know, the white people looking at you, judging you. I'm not interested in interacting with the white gaze at all. I'm not giving it the finger. I'm not appeasing it. I'm doing what I think is right. The second level of black intellectual maturation is learning to reject the black gaze, which is much harder. But that is really liberation for anybody who can achieve that.
Yeah, yeah. What do you say to the whole notion that, you know, a person is not black enough? You know, because you do address that in the book.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's a big part of what my book is about, and I think that's kind of a ridiculous way of looking at people. I mean, you know, this idea that there's a dogmatic or normative standard for blackness or some sort of sacrament that we must all take as black people, and if you don't do that, then you're not black enough. I mean, you know, I mean, what is this rule book? Where is it? I've never seen it. Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it either.
Who's ever seen it. And yet people keep quoting to me from it that black people don't skydive or black people don't go to therapy or black people don't do this or that. There's this awesome web series that I would encourage people to look at called blackfolkdon't.org. Right? I mean, the series is called Black Folk Don't, but you can find it at blackfolkdon't.org. And, you know, they in the trailer, I mean, there's an episode about therapy, there's an episode about traveling, there's an episode about tipping. The traveling one was news to me because we took trips. So black people I knew took trips, so I never knew that was a thing. The tipping and the therapy thing I was aware of, but that's a whole other thing. And we could talk about tipping later because it's a very, very deep thing. But in the trailer introducing the whole concept, this brother I know, Carl Hancock Rux, who's a fantastic poet, says, black folk, because they're asking everybody, black folk don't fill in the blank. And he says black folk don't agree on what it means to be black. Black folk don't agree on what black folk do and don't do.
That's true.
So, you know, there's a whole sort of, you know, the whole sort of discussion, active discussion on what it is that it means to be black. And I think that where we are now is that blackness is more varied and complex than it ever has been. Skip Gates says there's 40 million black people means there's 40 million ways to be black. So it's not that this is black and that's not. You know, you do that, that's black. You do that, that's not. That's ridiculous. You know, like, everybody, everything is black. I mean, you know, I look at it too, like, there's been, you know, it's I don't want to say disunity, but sort of fragmentation of what it means to be black. I mean, I'm trying to figure out what is the thing that is universal that connects all of us, that we all experience. I think those sort of things were easier to find in the 40s, 50s, 60s, maybe before that. Now, we all experience racism, which is a powerful experiential connector. But is that, I mean, what else beside that do we all share universally? You know, well, the biological characteristics that read as black, but that's a very broad set of characteristics. You know, if you think from, say, Derek Jeter to Alec Weck, I mean, you know, we look at everything in between there. I mean, you know, we look vastly different, and science, of course, rejects the concept of race. So you can't really locate it in a scientific or biological place. You know, we all share, to a certain extent, the collective memory, shared history, but we know that history differently, and then if we really want to land on the history, then Barack Obama's, where do we place him? You know, it gets very sort of weird and icky. So then we're back to the shared experience of racism. Which, okay, that's a major thing that connects all of us, but is that the only centrifugal force of all of blackness? I don't know. Sometimes, you know, just the community piece seems like the sort of matrix. Like we've decided that we are all one. But what is actually the glue? Well, because we decided it, okay. You know, but then, you know, when you add in the concept of like, well, we're going to throw some people out because they're not doing the right thing. You know, I mean, I need to see, and we don't see, actual treasonous actions, you know, that are directly detrimental to the black community. I mean, you know, does anybody talk about, you know, you're not black enough because you killed Malcolm X? Anybody talk about that? Anybody talk about you're not black enough because you deal drugs to the community?
Right.
Does anybody talk about you're not black enough because you infiltrated the Black Panthers and helped bring down that organization? No, it's you went to Yale and you talk like a white boy. Well, what is that?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, you know, because, you know, a lot of times what we see is that we are asked to choose between the doing the things that may lead to being successful in America or being black. And a lot of times the black community is not, some in the black community are not seeing how those can converge, that they're necessarily divergent, which is not a good bargain for us.
It's not. And do you think that skin color, you know, the hue of our skin helps to define, say, for the mainstream community, you know, if a person is black enough? And the reason why I say that is because a lot of times fairer skinned people are looked at a certain way as opposed to, you know, a darker skinned person. But like, as in my family, my mother was dark skinned, my father is light skinned. You know, we're a combination of everything. As you said earlier, we come from everything, you know, as light as light to as dark as dark. You know, where does this feeling come from? I mean, and the reason why I bring that up is because, to me, a lot of times you'll hear people, particularly I'm saying the mainstream community, but when they say the word black, it just has this tone and intonation to it. Are you kind of familiar with what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Like they say black, you know, that black man, you know, as opposed to us, we'll just say, you know, the black person, the black man or whatever. So it just seems as though, you know, a lot of us particularly.
Well, a lot of times I find that they are like sort of going out of their way, sort of in this comic way, to not say the black person. They haven't just find them any other way. He's wearing the blue sweater. Well, there's
right.
two people over there wearing blue sweaters.
With a blue
well, the one with the khakis. Well, what? Oh, the black
right.
guy over there? Oh, yeah, I know him. But,
yep.
I absolutely. Mean, you know, look, skin color is a very interesting thing within this. I mean, one of the things that I was shocked to find in my research, because in my book I interview 105 prominent black people, Skip Gates, Jesse Jackson, Cornel West, Mike Dyson, Malcolm Gladwell, Kara Walker, Melissa Harris Perry, on, professors, visual artists, you know, thinkers, writers, all sorts of people. One of the things I was surprised to find is that people, that it is generally black people who carry the water in terms of forwarding the idea of what it means to be light-skinned or dark-skinned. It is black people who are pushing forward the messages to each other of what that means. Now, of course, obviously, these are received opinions from white people, but we are the ones who are telling dark and light-skinned people what it means to be dark and light-skinned. I asked the darker-skinned people I interviewed if there was an advantage to being dark. And they either struggled to think of anything, or they would say things that were kind of pathetic, like, well, you get fetishized.
Wow.
You know, somebody said you get to see the look on people's faces when you start to talk and you are articulate.
Yeah.
The light-skinned people, they would either have two responses. They would say, like, I know I'm not supposed to talk about that. Like, I'm not supposed to talk about, you know, the advantages of having money. So now I'm very uncomfortable telling you what that is. Or they'd be like, well, there's this and 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 this. You know, but, you know, we see consistently that color impacts your life, and not just outside the black community, but within the black community. Michael Eric Dyson grew up in the late 60s, early 70s, Detroit area, very black community for him, around him. Brother in the home, different father. So his brother's dark-skinned, Michael's obviously very light-skinned. And he says this is not the only reason, color is not the only reason why their lives diverged so sharply, but it is part of the story, because Michael, from a very young age, was constantly getting the extra attention and the extra, just all the extras that would go along with somebody people thought of as having great potential, and was sort of, you know, accumulating advantages and momentum toward becoming a very intelligent person. And his brother was not. And, of course, Michael goes on to be one of the great intellectuals of academics of today, and his brother's doing life in prison. You know, and isn't that something? The two brothers could grow up in the same home and end up so different. This one brother, very dark-skinned brother named Saul Williams, great poet, lived in Brooklyn, grew up in Brooklyn in the 80s, when he got, very dark-skinned brother, when he got any kind of extra allowance money or what have you, he would spend it on bleaching cream to try to lighten his skin. Because he knew that that's what Michael Jackson was doing. So why can't I do it too? And his mother would tell him little things to say because, you know, everybody was always saying things. So, you know, playing the dozens and whatnot, and the hobbies. With him, they would always go right to color. So he's playing dozens with his friend, like his best friend, and his friend is, you know, hitting him on the color issue. And, you know, Saul says, you know, 15, 16 years old, Saul says, hey, you know, blacker the berry, the sweeter the juice. And right away his friend says, yeah, but nobody wants diabetes. I mean, you know, killed him. And he remembered that, and it hurt him. And even though it's his friend and they're just playing, it really hurt him. And it's kind of crazy that, like, you know, those sort of messaging, that sort of messaging is still there.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. What term do you think is more abrasive? African, I mean, I think I know what the answer is, but African-American or calling someone black? Because we still interchange.
The term is more abrasive?
Yeah, in a person's, the way they perceive black people. Because I notice certain people will call us African-Americans, other people prefer to call us black, but then they associate it with things like
people?
Blacklisted, blackballed, blackmailed. You know, it just, to some people, I've heard conversations on the side that it, you know, a negative connotation.
I mean, I really have no, really not interested in caring about the terms that white people choose.
Yes.
You know, it really doesn't matter to me. I mean, you know, my experience, both of those terms are equally, you know, respectful from them for the most part. I prefer black. I'm a writer. I like the poetry and the sound and the sort of power that I hear in black. I think of, you know, black power. You know, I think of black as beautiful. You know, I like that term. I like it sonically. I like the way it looks on the page. I like that it has one strong, clear syllable. African American bothers me. I like it in terms of demographically. It's a very clear locator for who you're talking about. Although black nicely links you to the diaspora.
Yes.
You know, but African American is a bit of a mouthful, slightly awkward. You know, and it's, you know what, it's awkward to a certain extent, sort of when you really unpack it. I mean, you know, I know that we're thinking about Africa as a unit representing the rupture in history, that we really don't know Africa because we're stolen from Africa. I get that, but you know what? Africa does not look at Africa as Africa. They're not a unit at all. And, you know, any more than we are North America a unit. You know, we don't, you know, we look down on Canada and Mexico as a nation. Like, they're not our brothers. We don't care about them. You know, they just happen to be next to us. But Africa does not look at Africa as a unit. You know, I mean, there's not even a single currency like there is in Europe. I mean, you know, they look at each other as countries, and they really understand those boundaries are drawn by Europeans, and they're really about the tribal boundaries that go back before the national boundaries that they have now. So that kind of alludes to the sort of romanticized vision of Africa that we operate with. You know, and to an Africa that does not exist. But then also, you know, we have many so-called African Americans, black Americans, who have no interest or desire in going to Africa. So they have they know nothing about Africa, they care to know nothing about Africa, and they don't even care to ever go to Africa. And I'm talking about people who actually have the money to do that. So, you know, we get things like Kwanzaa, which actually does not exist in Africa. It was created in Philadelphia in the 60s. So it's like, you know, it's not really Africa. It's this faux romanticized Africa. And then people get very upset when we talk about, you know, these African Americans who've never been to Africa and don't really care to go, even though they could, but then they don't want to hear about, well, Charlize Theron is African American. Well, why can't she be African American? Well, that's not what we're really talking about. Well, I know what you're really talking about, but this is what this word encapsulates. She is African American. She goes back to South Africa, and they're like, how are you? Nice to see you again, because she grew up there. So So how is she not African American? Because she's blonde and blue-eyed? Well, I mean, you know, as we already noted, science rejects the concept of race. So if you're locating it in a biological thing, then that's ridiculous. So, you know, now it just gets very messy. And
that's why I brought that up, because it's complicated.
It's complicated, you know.
What did you think about President Obama having to, quote-unquote, you know, address the black community through BET with that particular program that they did on him?
I didn't happen to watch that. I was watching something else, or I was out that night. Did he have to? I think that every president should be on BET. It's sort of
Absolutely. A failure
of imagination on BET's part that if it's a white president, they wouldn't demand he come and sit and talk to them too. I mean, like, he's the president of the United States. Black people's lives are affected by this individual. We're only talking to him because he's black. We're only sending BET reporters to the White House because now we have a black guy. And, like, you know, 4 years from now, when he's no longer president, we go back to a bunch of white guys now, or maybe Elizabeth Warren, we're not going to have a BET reporter in the White House anymore? That's ridiculous.
Exactly.
Why would you not have a BET reporter in the White House all the time? I don't know. I mean, maybe they will stay after the Obama administration ends. I kind of doubt it, you know, but what the president has to say impacts everybody.
Absolutely. Black or white, right?
Yeah.
Let me ask you this. From where we're at right now, we've got about 8 minutes to go in the program, and you do a lot of social commentary on things that are going on. Let's just take television real quick, since you are a fixture on television. What do you think about the whole phenomenon about, you know, and I mean, it's a good thing to one extent. You're going to understand what I say. It's a good thing to one extent, but on one part also, there should be more representation. This whole phenomenon now of, you know, these programs having one black person per program. You know, like, I mean, like an LL's on the show, Lawrence Fishburne's on the show. Like, we get one person out of a cast of 15 people or 7 people or 8 people. What do you think about what's going on in television?
I mean, you know, I'm happy to see brothers and sisters working. You know, they're actors. And, I mean, you know, look, there's a lot of shows that don't have one.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I can't... you know, it's not like there is a black spot on every show. You know, it's
right.
Probably more shows that don't have one than do. So, you know.
Yeah. No, I think it's a good thing. And I just bring that up to say, you know, like Murdoch, you know, he started his network back in the 80s, you know, on the shoulders of some wonderful, you know, African-American shows like Living Single, Rock, and Living Color, Martin. And then now you turn to the Fox Network, and there's not one, you know, show featuring African-Americans or black people on television. And
I think there's a Cleveland show?
There's a Cleveland? I haven't seen that one. Okay, that's on? There's one show?
I mean, you know, the Cleveland show is a weird example because it's an animated show. It's a black family, but it's animated. So there's no black actors,
yeah.
And there's actually white actors voicing the characters. But you know, the Cleveland show is extraordinarily popular among young black men. I think it's the number one show among, you know, quite as it's kept among young black men. So there's one thing, but yes, to your point, the tradition of really good black programming, and we're especially talking about Rock, it's a landmark show in terms of quality television show and quality black family on television, you know, exemplary black family on television. They don't have that now, which is sad.
It's sad, absolutely.
You know, I mean, you know, yeah.
Yeah. And when you talk about films and television, you know, because I know people who go out on castings and things like that, and there's always this term that's being used in castings called ethnically ambiguous.
Yeah.
You know, do you have any comments about that? About because it kind of fits in with, you know, how black is black, how, you know, how black, you just because you're light-skinned and now you're ethnically ambiguous, you know?
Yeah, I mean, some people, the way that race plays out in the street and the way it's going to play out in a Hollywood studio or in a Hollywood movie is totally different. You know, I mean, you know, someone like Jennifer Beals is ethically ambiguous to where she could play a white girl, she could play a black girl or a half black girl, Maya Rudolph, you know. I find it interesting when you see actresses like Rosie Perez occasionally who can get a role that's not already earmarked for a black or brown actress. It's a very tricky world for black and brown actresses.
Yeah. It was a comment in the chat. It wasn't a question, but they were saying, it's something that you were saying, that they feel that blackness should be synonymous with education. You have anything to comment about that?
That blackness should be synonymous with education?
With education, yes.
I don't quite understand your point.
Okay, yeah, I'm just reading it off. It was in the chat room.
I don't know.
So, what's ahead for you, Torre?
Working on a book about Prince. It's going to be a small book, but
wow.
It's going to be a book analyzing, should be out next summer, it'll be analyzing why he became an icon. Because to become an icon is more than being a star. It means that you are really reflecting the fears, anxieties, desires, longings of the generation, or at least your constituency. How did Prince fit into, anticipate, recognize, fulfill the fears, anxieties, desires, and longings of the generation, Generation X, and the baby boomers who are looking at him as well? They were older at that point. Generation X was young when he first rose up, but relatively young, and just entering the teens, really the oldest of the Gen Xers. I'm going to deliver that at Harvard. There's Skip Gates asked me to do it. There's an annual lecture series where you deliver one lecture over 3 days. So I'm going to do that in March, and then it becomes a book, which everybody will see. That'll be very interesting. And then I'm doing Nas's autobiography, which is about 2 years away, but we already finished the first chapter, and very excited about that. Extraordinary, extraordinary cat.
Yeah, sounds like I like Nas as well. You are you a big hip hop head, or you just like all types of music?
My life's hip hop.
Hip hop, man. Okay, that's your thing. Let me ask you this here. We got 2 minutes to go, and I know it's a tough question. You might just knock it out real quick. Do you think in our lifetimes that we will ever, you know, conquer the whole notion of racism?
I don't foresee that. No, I mean, it's sort of, I mean, you know, no, I mean, you know, you're talking about, I mean, when you're talking about racism, you're really talking about white supremacy. And
yes,
even as they are losing their grip on being the majority in America, or have already lost it and gone forever, they're still by far the majority in terms of who's in power. And I don't see that dissipating anytime soon.
Anytime soon, yeah.
You know, and, there are deep structural inequalities throughout America that are not going to be superseded anytime soon. I mean, you know, I've heard people talk about it like, you know, we're running a race, and they had not only they got a 100-yard lead in a 200-yard race, but we're running with a chain on, you know. Which makes the analogy very sort of plain and obvious. But, you know, just because some of us can sneak through doesn't mean that all of us can. There's deep structural problems that are holding back a lot of black America.
Right. I would say the masses, in my opinion. We've got about 30 seconds. Tell folks how they can find you.
You can find me on Twitter at Toure, T-O-U-R-E. Find me through Who's Afraid of Post Blackness on Facebook. Got a blog that I update occasionally. I should update it more often, but I haven't really had the time to kill it lately. But it's toure.typepad.com. And you see me on MSNBC's and Friday afternoons and the Dylan Radigan Show from 4 to 5. And the Hip Hop Shop is on Fuse Wednesdays at 11 on Fuse. And, yeah.
Absolutely. I love what you're doing, man. I admire what you do. Got a lot of good things happening out there. When you're done, I can tell. Well, you already have a great body. If you stop tomorrow, you have a great body of work.
Couldn't imagine that.
You can't imagine, because you always want more, right?
Couldn't imagine stopping tomorrow.
No, you wouldn't.
What am I going to do? I actually got a column that starts tomorrow on Time.com, Time Magazine's website. First column's probably going to bug you out because I wrote about when white people can say the N-word. And I don't like saying the N-word, but I'm just saying it because we're doing a podcast here. I'm sure you appreciate me not saying the actual N-word, but as a writer, it kills me to say the N-word instead of the actual word, which is part of what I'm talking about, that there's a difference between using it and talking about it, right? There's using a word. Talking about a word is not using it. That is a separate area of language. And so that's one of the two major areas that I locate. It's like, I don't mind a Barbara Walters saying Rick Perry had X head word on his property. That's not a racist usage. She's not even using it. She's reporting that it was used, and her being able to do that helps shame him for having done that. If she can't mention the word, but Sherry and Whoopi can, that's ridiculous.
Right, right.
That's absurd. That's comical. But there's a whole other area of usage that I support. So you have to check that out tomorrow.
But I saw a clip that you did on MSNBC about that children's book, and I thought that was very, very funny. How you address that. You got a great take on things, man, and it has to do with, you know, your perspective. I'm glad you talked about, you know, your family life in the beginning, because I think, you know, we need to see how various experiences, you know, shape how a person thinks and how a person feels. You're putting your thoughts and insights to in a good place, brother. I really do appreciate you. I know the listeners appreciate you, and we want to thank you for stopping by today.
Thank you.
Okay, have a great night.
All right, you too.